The Dolo White Podcast is brought to you by Cinema Anywhere Nashville. Follow Cinema Anywhere Nashville on Instagram and book your indoor or outdoor cinema experience today. Hey, it's Dolo White, and this is the Dolo White Podcast. Now, if there's one thing I love, it's talking anti-racism with fellow white people. There are way too few white people who identify as anti-racist, and even the ones of us that do still unknowingly find ways to uphold the system of white supremacy in this country. Now, I've said numerous times that I have failed my black friends, family members, and even my wife too many times when it comes to speaking up when faced with a white friend or family member's racist views or outbursts. That's something that is ingrained in almost every white person from birth. We look the other way when something racist is said. We just brush it off like that's how your uncle is. Well, staying silent is a hard habit to break, especially for someone like myself who clings to comfort and hates confrontation. All things I'm working on in therapy, but there's an extra layer when it comes to racism, extra discomfort. But we can't let that be a crutch or an excuse. We have to confront it every time. But what is it that we really want? We want to change our loved ones' views, and oftentimes we don't think we're capable. The one thing I've learned both through this podcast and through hard life experiences is that we, as anti-racist white people, have to say something. That's where it starts, and that's why I'm so happy to have my guests today because they wrote a whole book on that subject. Let's welcome in Eleanor Bartoli and Allie Michael, authors of Our Problem, Our Path, Collective Anti-Racism for White People. Let's get this anti-racist shit started. Welcome to the Dolo White Podcast.
Polo Giddy. Love.
Yeah.
What's up? This is not live. It's completely recorded.
Broadcasting from one of the top recording studios in all of Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah, that's not true at all. I'm probably at home doing this.
He's been called one of the greatest thinkers of his time.
Literally no one has ever called me that. I do kind of agree with it, though.
A 2017 recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's just a flat-out lie.
Talking politics, community, race, religion, entertainment, sports, and whatever the fuck else.
Yeah.
It's the Dolo White Podcast.
All right, episode 83 now of the Dolo White Podcast. My guest today, very happy to have you guys on. Something I talk about all the time is anti-racism. So I'm glad to have the authors of Our Problem, Our Path, Collective Anti-Racism, Eleanor Bartoli and Allie Michael. Thank you guys for being here.
Thanks for having us, Dolo White. It's such a pleasure.
I love talking anti-racism with fellow white people. It's one of my, honestly, like one of my passions because it feels like there's not enough of us in the world, and here you guys are writing a book about it. So let's start with that. What started you guys each individually on the path to anti-racism? Like, what was the light that went off in your head that said, we've got to do more?
For me, it was, well, first of all, 18 years old, taking a class on African-American literature and realizing all the stuff I didn't know about our history as a country and all the ways I have been trained at that point not to talk about race, not to see it, to think, to be colorblind. But the light, like the really, the thing that changed everything for me was studying abroad in South Africa and living with a Black family 4 years after apartheid had ended and seeing how much racialized policy can impact people's lives and can really destroy human potential or limit a society by ruling out so many people who could potentially be a part of it, participate, contribute. And it was that relationship with that family that I still continue to today that helped me see things that I think are really hard to see in your own country. Mm-hmm. But over time, I started to realize like, wow, I can get really mad about politics in South Africa. And in the U.S., I'm a white person. And we have a not very dissimilar history.
Right.
Yeah.
And I have a slightly different trajectory because I was born and raised in Italy. And I came here as a late adolescent. And I noticed pretty quickly that there was something that there was some stratification based on race. But every time I asked a question, I was shut down for asking the wrong question or mentioning the unmentionable or told that I was racist for just having that question or noticing race. And eventually, during my internship years, I was training as a clinical psychologist. I, for the first time, watched a documentary, The Color of Fear, which is absolutely iconic. And I hope that folks will still see it to these days. And in that documentary, there is a character called David who really had all the same question that I had. And he had the courage to speak them out. And of course, everybody was so mad at him for not understanding. And I knew that he was asking the quote unquote wrong question, but I held the same ones. And so finally, I began peeling back the the sort of veil over what was clearly going on around me and the truth of the way in which the concept of racism allowed me to make sense of so much of what went around me. I just couldn't turn my eyes and I made it the rest of my career.
Yeah. And I think we as white people, it's embedded in us in a young age to, when you see something racist, you just be quiet about it and you become small and you're just like, you kind of curl up. If it makes you uncomfortable, that's good. But what I've learned in my later life and what I failed so many times in the past doing was saying, hey, you can't say that. Like, this is why what you just said is wrong. And this behavior needs to be corrected. And I went through that. It took me years before I finally started gathering the courage to speak up. So tell us about the book, Our Problem, Our Path, Collective Anti-Racism. First of all, what is collective anti-racism?
Collective anti-racism is the idea that it's not enough to have one white person who's being anti-racist or like, you know, the most woke anti-racist person in the organization who kind of makes everybody else feel like they're not worthy. I mean, honestly, that was me at a certain point at different places of work or, you know, you see that where like white people start to kind of, it's like, I'm anti-racist for my own self-image. I'm anti-racist to soothe my own guilt. Collective anti-racism is about like, you know, no matter how much I make my dad feel guilty for the things that he might say unwittingly, at the end of the day, we're both pretty much we're both white people in a racial hierarchy. We haven't dismantled the system, even though I made him feel guilty and that makes me feel better about myself. Collective anti-racism is about looking at the people around you, the white people around you, and saying, what do you need to know? And what support do you need in order to walk an anti-racist path in your life? Because at the end of the day, it's not enough for me to be the rabid or the strong anti-racist. We need millions. We need millions of white people to walk an anti-racist path for 8 generations, which is a number that Resmaa Menakem gives us. And if we're going to do, and not just like, it's not like if we keep having children, we're going to like eventually have racial justice. That's not true. If we actually work toward it for 8 generations, we can shift the system, but it's going to take a lot more people. And frankly, I think most people of color and most Native people don't have the time and energy to help white people learn and know what they need to know in order to be anti-racist actors. And so that's also part of why white people need to get in there and start supporting each other to learn what we need to learn.
How hard is that now with, I'm in Nashville, Tennessee, and Nashville is as liberal and as cool as it is an outlier in the state. And they're passing laws where you can't teach this and you can't teach that. And how hard is it in this day and age to get this information into the household of the people that need to hear it most?
So sometimes I think we don't recognize that the conversation is hard or why it's hard. And so as soon as it becomes hard, we shy away and back off. And I think people want to understand themselves and want to understand how they got to the place that they got. And if you help them figure out not just what's wrong with them, which is often what we tell ourselves as white people, but what happened to you, what happened to us as white people, that we end up having very similar reactions and very similar mishaps in our attempts at being good people in the world, then they can begin undoing what has been done in terms of socialization to them and take the steps in the right direction.
And, you know, there are a lot of laws. I know there are laws in Tennessee right now about against talking about race. And, right. And again, you know, all the anti-critical race theory laws. And I just feel like, is it really possible that first of all, these laws are coming out of a very coordinated campaign, which researchers at UCLA have called the conflict campaign. It's a political campaign that was designed to sow conflict at the local level, at the school board level, which is exactly where we see it. And I just think we have so many people who see that this is wrong. And we have youth who can learn from anywhere. They can learn from the internet. They can learn from books. So even if they're not reading it in school, I mean, that makes a big difference. And we have to work against those laws. But I don't believe that that can stand when we have so many people who already know and who can find the information elsewhere if it's outlawed, if it's outlawed in school, essentially the way that it is right now. The trick is that we're, like you said at the beginning, we're really good at being bystanders. White people are good at, I mean, that's like my, I not only did I learn to be colorblind as a child, but if I heard a racist joke, I learned you just kind of laugh uncomfortably. And then afterwards, after the person leaves, you say, don't say that. But I didn't see, I didn't have anti-racism modeled for me, like how to talk to that person. And in a way that it doesn't even have to be a huge conflict. I don't have to break off my relationship with that person. You can engage in anti-racism in a way that just says, I'm not going there. I don't like that. Or nah, you know, I mean, there's so many different ways we could respond to racist humor that it doesn't necessarily have to be shaming. Like, listen, you're such a good guy. Why would you say that? I don't, you know, that like, I love you so much. I wouldn't have expected that that joke would be one of yours, you know, something like that.
It does seem like white people, the second you call them out for something or say something to them, it's defensive. It's, oh, no, I'm not racist. I just said some really racist shit. You know what I mean? Like, so what is the best way to kind of approach that and to have like a conversation? Because when somebody gets defensive, it turns into an argument and there's no fruit. No, nobody moves an inch in that scenario. So how do we start moving the needle a little bit?
Well, when we start fighting, it's because we say something that we're using shorthand. We expect the other person to understand, and then they don't understand it. They just think they're being called racist. And we get, you know, that you're privileged or, you know, that's racist. And it's like often people don't have the history or the background to understand what it is we're trying to express. And so part of it is like intervening with somebody where they are. So if, you know, like, what do you need to know to take your next step to understand this? And then we have to understand that it is extremely shaming to be called out on your racist shit. And so we need to say like the formula I use is support, confront. I'm going to support you, support what I see that's good in you, what I love about you. And then I'm going to confront the behavior or challenge it. And then Eleonora adds another piece to this. So we support the person, challenge the behavior, and then we contextualize it. Because so often the things that we say that are racist or that are rooted in a racial caste system are things that sometimes we don't even know are problematic because we like normalize this racial caste system that we live in. And then we're surprised when people say things that are in line with it, you know? And what, so support, challenge, contextualize means we take it back to the systemic level and say like, but of course that joke seemed funny. Because we live in a society that often tells us it's okay to that Black people are laughable, you know? And so like, that's a system I was raised in too. And you take it to the system level so that you take it away from individual blame and recognize like, again, you and I were socialized in the same system. That's the system we're trying to dismantle. Taking you out, making you feel bad is not going to change that system, but you are somebody who could be an active player in working against the racial caste system, which really is a system that dehumanizes all of us.
Are there people that are too far gone?
It's a good question.
I'm a psychologist. I'm going to be the endless optimist. Almost no one is beyond hope unless there is some, you know, physiological damage to their empathy capacity. However, you have to kind of want it at least a little bit. And so sometimes, you know, there was this great training that we both, I and I took early on in our journey. And it talked about sort of, you try to move everyone one slice over, but also put your emphasis and your work in the sphere of influence that you have the most impact in, because that's where you're going to be the most productive. And so sometimes we think, well, I need to go get that 10%, 15% who does not want to change. And if I don't get them, then everything is lost. When in fact, we probably have incredible amount of access and willingness from 80%+ of the population, and 80%+ will change things. And so act where you are, as you are, in the sphere of influence that you have, and that will move the dial.
I think the hard part is when there's so much misinformation that is consumed by a race of people or certain, I don't even want to say the whole race of people, but a certain large percentage of a race of people that solely consumes this one type of media, this one platform, this one ideology. And then you come in and say, yeah, that's bullshit. And this is what's really happening. I think it can be eye-opening in the moment, but the moment you leave, they're right back to, you know, Tucker Carlson that night. You know what I mean? And I think that's kind of where the battle is a lot of times. It's just, it's people getting one side of one thing constantly and then going to talk about it with their friends and family members. And then one outlier coming in and saying, hey, do you agree? Can we agree on this? And you find something, you might find something that you do agree on. And then the second the conversation is over, they're right back doing the same shit they were doing before. I'm glad you guys are optimistic. It's hard for me to be so sometimes because I see this a lot. I mean, I grew up white and in the South with, you know, a father that's from the middle of nowhere in Kentucky. And I have family members from the middle of nowhere. You know what I mean? And it's an uphill battle. I'll say that.
Yes, definitely an uphill battle. It is. I mean, there's no doubt. And I think that, I mean, I really admire like what you're doing and where you are. And it's powerful. I mean, it's a statement about like how each of us can do with something where we are. I mean, I think the thing is like when you look at QAnon and some white supremacist alt-right movements, people who leave those movements say, and even people who are still in them say, well, the reason why I joined was because I wanted somewhere where I felt like I belonged and where I was respected. And I think that sometimes it's so funny. It's like, these are hate movements that are more effective at recruiting members than anti-racism, which I really think is a love movement. It's right. About spreading love. It's about loving people. And yet like the bar to entry feels so high because we feel like we have to be perfect. We have to get it right all the time. And I think white people really contribute to that with other white people. It's really easier to write somebody off and say like, well, that's just racist. Or you're a racist or you're ignorant, then to like talk to them and to stay engaged with them over the long term. So you're right. Like sometimes in a given conversation, they go right back to the same media that they were watching before. But like transformation is not going to happen in one hot conversation. It's going to happen over time. And with people with whom you're in relationship that who you know actually care about you and respect you. And so we were inviting people to think about anti-racism as a love movement and to think in loving, to be in loving relationship with other white people. And sometimes, like Eleanor said, sometimes there's like 10% of people that's like, we're not going to engage with them because there's actually 60% who would be on board if they had an entree and if they had like somebody to say like, look, here's the trailhead, come walk this path with me. But the African-American Policy Forum run by Kim Crenshaw really says like that the conflict campaign is meant to sow divisions. The more that we can be pro-unity, that we can build relationships, that we can talk to people one-on-one, that's how we're going to make shifts, particularly in the upcoming election, but for our future. She says it's not going to be social media. It's not going to be through the news because all of that stuff is too big. It's not relationship-based, that we need to be building relationships and letting people know we care about them and then speaking up, losing that bystander training that we have and speaking up and saying, what are you for? I'm pro unity. I'm pro truth. I'm pro history. I'm pro community. And just getting out there, getting into public spaces, school board meetings, and you don't have to have a complex argument. You just have to say like, well, this is what I stand for. And I don't hate the other side, but I stand for these things because I stand for them too.
My last question before I let you guys out of here, I know you're probably doing a million of these today. I always say the most important thing white people can do is to actually listen to actual black and brown people. What is the most important thing white people can do in you guys' opinion?
One of the best quotes that I have heard is relationships build at the speed of trust and social change builds at the speed of relationship. So don't underestimate how key those relationships are and how much change can be done if we stay in fact in connection with one another. So the one thing that the CRT and other campaigns are doing are dividing us both within amongst white people and among people of different racial backgrounds. And so the most important thing is to actually learn to listen and to remain in relationships.
And I'll just add to that, you know, the most important thing for white people is to build the skill and resilience to be able to listen without going into fight, flight, freeze mode. That I could listen to the pain or the truth or the joy of people of color and Native people, the reality of what has happened to them and to their groups over time in this country. And I could like really hear it and take it in an empathetic connection rather than be like, no, I can't. No, I have to defend against it. I don't want to hear it because it makes me feel bad about myself.
I love it. Get the book, Our Problem, Our Path, Collective Anti-Racism. Eleonora Bartoli, Allie Michael, thank you guys so much for doing this.
Thanks, Delawite. You're awesome.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Cinema Anywhere Nashville. You can book your indoor or outdoor cinema experience right now, starting at only $350. Cinema Anywhere Nashville provides your choice of a 16, 24, 36, or even a 100-foot screen, plus projector setup and sound system. This is a super dope service that wouldn't just be great for corporate and work events, but also birthday and holiday parties, or if you want to have a romantic evening with your significant other, Cinema Anywhere Nashville is perfect for all of those things. They have the right experience for you. Follow them on Instagram right now at Cinema Anywhere Nashville and book your cinema experience today. I want to say thank you once again to my guests, Eleonora Bartoli and Allie Michael. Check out their book, Our Problem, Our Path, Collective Anti-Racism for White People. Definitely a great read there. Anyway, don't forget to follow me Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, everything at DolaWhite101, D-O-L-E-W-I-T-E 101. And no matter what platform you're listening to this podcast on, make sure you are subscribed. Make sure you follow or whatever the hell they call it on that platform. Auto-download is also a great way to show me love. That's it. Brand new episode next Wednesday. I got Giovanni Ricciuti. He's coming on to talk about finding your heritage, immigration, and a lot about Italy. So if you're an Italy lover like my family is, definitely check out next week's episode. It's super dope. That's my time. I'm out. Back next week. Thanks for listening.